I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Katie Blackburn. Katie is the Executive Vice President for the Cincinnati Bengals. And let's talk about how the Bengals have really become, in my view, much more fan-friendly over the last year or so.
We have taken a lot of steps to try to reach out to the fans, and there are a couple of things that we did this year in particular for some reason. We started out when we had to set our ticket prices for this year. We took a look, and obviously the economy has affected a lot of families, especially in this area. So we repriced a lot of our seats and lowered over 27% of our seating bowl in terms of trying to make it a more affordable event that our fans will be able to attend. So that was one of the things. Another thing that we did this year is we brought training camp back to the city of Cincinnati, and we really thought it was going to be a great fit to have training camp in Cincinnati where our fans could come down and watch us, and it was a little closer to home, and that really worked out great. It was a success on all fronts. It worked for the team. It worked, I think, for our fans, so we're looking forward to that being a great thing going forward, too.
Is it a lot tougher when you're having the team at home versus away? I mean, is there more work involved in preparing for a home game?
For certain people, obviously there's a lot of staff that's working at a home game, be it the concession staff, the security and operations management. So there is definitely a lot of work that goes into having a home game from a lot of standpoints that you don't have to deal with when it's an away game. From a football standpoint, I think the team gets ready the same way week in and week out.
There are a lot of people in our listening audience who may never have been to a Bengals game. So in an effort to let them know what they may be missing and hopefully come and attend one of those, what can they expect when they come to a Bengals game that might be surprising to them?
A lot of people like to tailgate and come early and serve up some food to themselves in the parking lots.
And beverage.
We have an area on the plaza of the stadium where we have a band that plays pregame and some other interactive events. Obviously, the games themselves this year is the year to come because we have a great home schedule. We have Dallas coming, the New York Giants, Denver with Peyton Manning, Pittsburgh Steelers on Sunday night. So we have a really, really great home schedule this year, too, which is really the main thing that it's all about.
And there's still tickets available.
We would love to have everyone come to one of our games this year, and it's a great day from the start of the game to the end. You can go online or you can call our ticket office at 513-621-8383.
Katie, we're out of time today, but tomorrow when we come back, I want to talk a little more personal. It's going to be very interesting to me to learn from you what it was like growing up in a football family. For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney Faulkner and Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is BusinessWise. Today our guest is Katie Blackburn. Katie is the Executive Vice President of the Cincinnati Bengals. And Katie, you've been involved with the Cincinnati Bengals virtually your entire life. What's it like to work in a family business? Are you ever able to leave the business at the office? In your case, the office, I guess, is the stadium. Or do you still work on it when you go home?
One of the things that I love about what I do is that it is a family business. And I feel so honored to have the family history of my grandfather and my dad, my brother and my uncle and my husband, and we're all a part of the business. And that really is something that makes me even feel more tied into it and really wanting to see it all go the right way, because you want everything to go right for your family as much as everyone. And it gives you that much more heartfelt effort in everything you do about with the business. But, you know, it is true, though, that you never get away from it. And some of it's because it's a fun social business, too. So some of what a lot of other people are doing when they're getting away from their work is they love to talk about football. So when, you know, whether it's we're at home or we're with friends, it's just a topic that comes up, and we're always glad to talk about it and have it be a part of what we do.
So Katie, I know we have kids similar in age. We both have seniors in high school, and a little different for our family business. So our daughter, you know, learned what a Roth IRA was when she was four. And in your case, your daughters have grown up with football as well. Do you see them going into the business potentially?
I sort of take the approach that I think my dad took with me. I did, after I went to college, I went to law school and I worked in a law firm for 2 years. And he always said, you know, make sure that there's not something else out there that you really want to do more. But to me, it was a no-brainer. And as if I had the opportunity and was lucky enough to be able to continue, it was something that I jumped at the opportunity to do.
Let's talk about the Bengals, because, you know, diehard football fan. I love going to the games. I grew up with that whole football environment as well. But it has to be a lot different for you every day that you have a game. I mean, for us, it's an event, it's an outing, it's fun, but it's still got to be somewhat work for you.
Well, you know, everything about the game is exciting. And certainly, I would say really the game day, it's all about football, which so that makes it our favorite day. And the fans and football, and the fans can get there and tailgate and enjoy our activities that we have out on the plaza before the game and enjoy the game. So really, the day of the game is the best part. It's the other days of the week where there are so many other things that are happening, be it medical related, even IT related, just all the normal things that you have in any other business that, you know, sort of keep you on your toes and working at it.
Well, even IT wise, I mean, now do all the players have iPads so they keep their plays on those?
We did go to that this year where all the playbooks are now on iPads. And, you know, we sort of see it as something where they are obviously doing this in a lot of schools, the potential you have to be able to teach players and incorporate video and do so many exciting things with that.
So how do you get the players prepared mentally to go on the field and be ready to go? How do you do that? What kinds of things do they do?
The players, they spend the night together at the hotel before the game, and they get up and they have a pregame meal. But, you know, in fairness, that all falls to the head coach. He's the one who mentally gets them prepared and hopefully ready to give it their best effort every Sunday.
So, Katie, if people listening had never been to a game, and certainly our listening audience is now pretty broad, they'd like to come down for a game, how would they get tickets?
Well, they can go online to Bengals.com, or they can call our ticket office, 513-621-8383. And we have a great schedule with a lot of exciting teams this year, so hopefully people will take advantage of that.
For Business Wise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is Business Wise. Tom, we hear complaints so many times from business owners about the magnitude of regulations that are hindering the growth of small businesses.
While large businesses have the same amount of regulations, they generally have in-house legal departments and the bureaucracy that they can handle those types of burdensome rules much easier than a small business who typically doesn't have those types of resources.
The state of Ohio has recently initiated a new initiative called the Common Sense Initiative.
And, you know, that's a surprise by itself, right? I mean, who associates common sense with any government authority?
Right. But in this case, I really do think, because I'm a little close to this, I'm actually on the Small Business Advisory Council that is part of the Ohio Common Sense Initiative, that the state is really trying to eliminate burdensome, unnecessary rules and regulations that are holding business growth back. Some of these rules were established perhaps 25, 30, 40, or even 50 years ago when there may have been a very good reason why it was originally put into place. But now, life has changed, things have changed, so it's time to revisit those.
Well, unfortunately, every time there's a problem, someone has a legislative fix for that problem or to prevent that problem, and some of that legislation no longer is needed. And that's sort of what Common Sense Initiative is trying to do, isn't it? Get rid of unnecessary rules that aren't providing any good to the state or to the people.
Absolutely. But the only way that this is going to work is for businesses who are being impacted in Ohio by unnecessary rules and regulations to actually come forward and share what those issues are. It's not a guarantee that every rule or regulation that you as a business owner may think is unnecessary is in fact able to be eliminated. But certainly, until administrators, elected officials know about it, there's nothing that can be done. So my point is that if you are listening today and your business is being impacted by an unnecessary rule or regulation, in your opinion, reach out to the Common Sense Initiative by going to www.governor.ohio. At that website, you'll find a link under Priorities and Initiatives where you can submit your suggestions and your issue. You can always reach out to me as well. As I mentioned, I am on the Small Business Advisory Council for that initiative. So part of my role is to be the voice of small business in this region.
Well, and there's actually been some successes. I mean, some businesses have managed to get needless regulations changed so they're no longer hindering their ability to grow.
They certainly have. And one of those was an EPA issue. A small asphalt company was trying to conduct air emissions as a part of a permit. And even though the company had just recently conducted a test similar to the test that they are currently going through, the EPA was going to require this needless, excessive cost in doing the same test.
The Ohio EPA,
The Ohio EPA, exactly. This business owner brought the matter to the attention of the Common Sense Initiative, and those rules were changed.
Well, maybe we will start associating common sense with state government.
Let's hope so. For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Tom, we're quickly approaching the end of the year and time's running out for a few very important tax strategies that business owners may want to take advantage of.
Especially business owners who are considering passing on their business or a part of their business to someone else, normally a family member. Because right now the estate tax law lets you pass a little more than $10 million if you're a married couple without any immediate tax consequence. Right now, the law is scheduled to reduce that to $2 million January 1st of 2013.
Right. So absent any future legislation, the way the law is going to read come January 1st is that married couples can only give away $2 million. That's a huge difference. So if you were thinking about transferring wealth, if you do have assets that you think it may make sense to gift to your children, then this is the time to certainly take advantage of the rules.
Well, it is, and it may also be a good time to value your business because depending on what your business has done in the last several years, in many cases, businesses are still not at their peak and the valuations may be relatively low, which would allow you to give a larger chunk of your business away under this exemption.
You know, we hear so many times that one of the big reasons why business owners are unwilling or reluctant to transfer their business is because they don't want to lose control. But there are many ways that a business owner can still maintain a significant level of control and pass on the wealth to save the tax for the family.
There's lots of ways to retain voting control. You can, depending on the type of legal entity you have, you can have other restrictions. You can transfer assets in a trust. There's many ways of controlling what you're transferring. The key, I think, is deciding whether or not you want to make a gift of your interest, and if so, if it makes sense to do it in 2012.
And certainly we've been talking about transferring a business, but there are many other assets that business owners own that may also make sense to transfer. For example, real estate is just an ideal asset that can be leveraged and taken advantage of.
Well, and often real estate used to house the business is owned by an entity separate from the business entity. And oftentimes that's a limited liability company or a limited partnership, and you can carve out a piece of that partnership to transfer without really relinquishing control.
Another issue as it relates to any type of gift of a minority interest, this is which most people tend to take advantage of. They want to make a gift, but to the extent they want to maintain majority control, they're gifting a minority interest. And so for tax purposes, you can actually transfer a lot more in many instances because of the minority interest that you're giving away. It's just not worth as much as a majority interest.
A 40% interest in the business is not worth 40% of the entire value of the business. It's worth something less because you don't control the business.
And another discount that you can take advantage of is the lack of marketability. So many closely held businesses or parcels of real estate, you just can't go out and trade those stock units or LLC units easily. So the IRS will allow you to take a discount for lack of marketability.
Well, there's many mechanisms for being able to transfer the ownership of your assets. The important thing is to start down the path now if you plan on doing something in 2012, decide who you're going to make the transfers to, what restrictions you might want to put on them, and start getting your values in line.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is BusinessWise. My guests today are Chris Kemper. Chris is the Director of Public Relations at the Cincinnati USA Regional Chamber, and Pat Sheeran, who is the Vice President of Corporate and Community Programming at the Chamber. Gentlemen, I'm pretty active with the Chamber. I have been for many years, but I was surprised when I first got involved at the extent of work that the Chamber does in this community. Everything from putting on parties in the park, Oktoberfest, the Taste of Cincinnati, to Cincinnati Tech, Cincy Tech.
Yep.
working on the Ohio Jobs Program, Minority Business Incubator, all kinds of things.
Yeah, our chamber, the Cincinnati USA Regional Chamber, is actually the fifth largest metro chamber in the country. And Cincinnati is roughly the 24th or 25th largest metro region. So it really speaks to our size and scope and how much territory we cover. And we do, you're absolutely right. We do a lot of different things and we have different brands, and people might not realize that they all kind of fit together under the umbrella that is the chamber. So you have the festival business, and that really gives us an opportunity to have some fun, to shine the light on downtown Cincinnati and show people that it is such a great, vibrant place to live. But then we're also involved in business attraction and retention with the Cincinnati USA Partnership, which is the primary economic development entity for the region. And the partnership is the brand hub work is being done. Mm-hmm. And if you haven't heard of that, the brand hub is the initiative to try to identify Cincinnati worldwide as a global branding hub and center.
What makes sense, right? I mean, we have a lot of those types of companies here with Procter & Gamble and right. Kroger and Macy's.
Exactly. And then Nielsen has its second largest office here worldwide. dunnhumby has such a great story to tell. And it all fits into that initiative that it's the brand hub, which ties into other initiatives like Centrifuge and Cincy Tech. We're one of the three founders of Cincy Tech along with Children's and UC, and they've done great work.
Well, why don't you share what Cincy Tech is all about? Because I'm thinking many people don't realize.
Cincy Tech is a public-private partnership, and it is a seed stage investor for startup companies. And they have great stories. They have their first exit last year. And really, it's part of that ecosystem that we're in the process of building to grow Cincinnati into a center of innovation and entrepreneurialism.
My involvement with the chamber has been varied throughout the years, but my personal most recent involvement is with the Governmental Affairs Program. Mm-hmm. And that's another value that the chamber brings to many businesses, including smaller businesses who don't have resources to have their own internal advocacy programs.
Yeah, we advocate at all levels of government, and really our staff is led by Matt Davis. And it's very important for our members such as you to be involved, because our voice is amplified when our members are telling us how various legislation affects them.
Well, and additionally, you know, for the small and mid-sized business owner that may not have direct access to public officials, you know, some of the programming we do put them in the room with the top leaders. In fact, we led a delegation 4 months ago that spent an hour and a half with Governor Kasich. And every small business owner and middle market business owner in the room could ask him any question they wanted.
Well, and let's talk about Agenda 360, because that gets a lot of press attention, but many people may not, again, understand the impact that that's having.
Agenda 360 has three overarching goals. It is essentially the regional action plan for the region. The overarching goals are 200,000 net new jobs by 2020, 150,000 net new young professionals, and it's the third is tied in with United Way's goal of essentially lifting people out of poverty. Agenda 360 is directly involved in some of those initiatives, and then they work with other partners such as United Way and Strive to get other things done.
And if folks would like to learn more about the chamber, if they'd like to get involved with the chamber, the website is?
CincinnatiChamber.com. I would encourage anyone to sign up for our newsletters. They are e-newsletters that go out every week to keep up with what we're doing. And if you want to be a member, by all means, contact Pat or anyone else that wants to join.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner with Cooney Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is BusinessWise. Today, our guests are Mary Stageman. Mary is Vice President for Regional Initiatives and Executive Director of Agenda 360 for the Cincinnati USA Regional Chamber. And also joining us is Ross Meyer. Ross is the Executive Director of Partners for a Competitive Workforce. Together, you worked on a report called the 2020 Jobs Outlook. This looked at what jobs are going to be needed in our region down the road in the year 2020. What kind of skills are people going to need for those jobs? Is everybody going to have a college degree to be employed anywhere in 2020?
The jobs that will be available will distribute across a sort of range of skill bases, and that in some respects we would be better served by moving people into post-secondary credentialing of some kind, like a certificate that's specific to a particular skill like welding, so that they can get gainful employment and then throughout their careers in life can certainly ladder up their education. But it sort of does a little myth-busting around the idea that everyone should go directly into a four-year degree program. Now, I want to be really clear. We are not saying that bachelor's degrees don't matter. In fact, bachelor's degrees and above are leading indicators of economic prosperity, and we want more and more people that hold that credential in our region because they come with and match up with high-paid, high-skilled jobs. But we think we would help a lot of people in our region achieve career status and much more gainful employment more quickly if we help them get the skills they need to get a job before we talk to them about additional degrees and education.
One thing I'll add to that is, I mean, the report was pretty clear that, you know, some sort of post-secondary education and credential is basically required for any good paying job in the future, be it a degree or a certificate, associate's degree, some is required. But what we didn't really reveal in this report, but what we hear every day from employers is that, yes, you know, the technical skills and the education is required and is generally lacking in the kind of applicants that they're looking at today. But what's possibly more important is kind of the fundamental skills of basic work readiness skills, showing up on time, being dependable, critical thinking, problem solving, these kind of softer skills that are, in fact, you know, more important at times to employers. They often have a hard time finding people with those skills, too. So we know it's a combination of, you know, the right kind of skills and training related to the job, but it's also the fundamentals.
Why do you think that is? Do you think it's because schools are so focused on teaching to the tests that they don't have time to teach some of those basic life skills?
You know, possibly. I think it's in the classroom and it's at home too. I mean, these kind of basic skills of integrity, dependability, treating each other with respect. I think oftentimes if you're so focused on teaching to a test, you can't really address some of these more fundamental skills. But it's also an issue for our parents and our faith community. It's an issue that we all need to figure out how we can address on really getting people ready for work.
Mary, what role does the chamber or businesses in general have in really making this 2020 jobs outlook come to fruition?
Well, I think that for the chamber, first of all, we have recognized over the last year or two that we need to be much more engaged in the workforce business than we have been for the last few years. And our partnership with Ross's organization and others is a big part of that shift in our thinking. I think when we think about our members and all of the businesses in our community, we would ask them to sit down and have a conversation with us about what is really revealed in this report, how they as employers can help inform the process and work together with educators, with families, with all of the providers in this region to make sure we have the workforce for the future.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Katherine Keller. Katie Keller is a senior program officer at the Health Foundation of Greater Cincinnati. And we're talking today about health care reform, the Protection Affordable Care Act, which, as we all know, has been the subject of much controversy. You specialize in the ins and outs of the health care reform.
Yeah, so the Health Foundation of Greater Cincinnati has a program to educate the local community and small businesses about what's in the Affordable Care Act. It's a law that will affect all of us in some shape or form, and we believe that it's important that we all know what we should be looking forward to and what's going to be happening. So if you think about the general overview of the Affordable Care Act, its intention is to expand health coverage for the majority of Americans, improve the quality of health care that we receive, and to begin to slow the increase in health care costs.
And how was that impacted by the recent Supreme Court decision that sort of held up at least most of the tenets of that act?
So there were two major decisions that came out of the Supreme Court. The first one was whether or not the federal government could mandate each and every one of us to have health insurance. The court decided that because it was structured through the IRS, that the mandate was structured as a tax, and that is constitutional, that the federal government has the power to tax. So while it can't be a penalty, which is how it was written in the law, it can be a tax, and therefore it is constitutional for them to tax us if we don't have insurance.
It's interesting because this is the law today as it stands.
Correct.
However, it's causing many businesses some anxiety because I think many people feel that this law could be overturned depending on what happens in the November election. Do you think that people should wait until after the election to really start figuring out how the Health Care Act is going to impact them, or should they be doing things now?
Because it is a law, I think you should certainly be responding to things that are happening now. None of us have a crystal ball to know what's going to happen in November and even what's going to happen next year with the law. I think it would be difficult to overturn a law that is had significant portions of it implemented already, but we just have no way of knowing. So I would think most businesses should be seeing what they need to be doing now. Policies are coming up for review. People are signing up for 2013. They need to be deciding, you know, are they going to be a grandfathered plan or a new plan, and see what their policies have started to change. So such as things like preventive care now doesn't have co-pays. Adult children up to 26 can stay on your plans. No lifetime limits on your health insurance coverage. So there are policy changes that are currently happening because of the law that employers should certainly be aware of. There are also tax implications. There are things for especially small businesses. There are tax credits. So if you have under 25 full-time employees, businesses should be checking out whether or not they are eligible for the tax credit.
What do you think businesses should be doing? They should assume that law as it now stands is going to stay intact, and they need to plan for those additional taxes and policy changes?
I think so. I mean, until anything changes and the law has changed, I think you need to go with it as the law is intended to be implemented. So I think you need to check into your tax implications, make sure your policies are, you know, work with your providers on your insurance to have all the policies fit the new structures, and to be aware for, there are some changes coming in 2013 that you should be preparing for.
If people would like information about the healthcare reform or to reach you, what's your contact?
They can contact us through our website at reform.healthfoundation.org.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Catherine Keller. Katie is a senior program officer at the Health Foundation of Greater Cincinnati, and she's responsible for the organization's Affordable Care Act education program. And you're kind of our local expert on the Affordable Care Act, and that's going to be an important base of knowledge because it's starting to affect more and more people and more companies. And one of the things I've heard about and read about, but I don't know a lot about yet, are these insurance exchanges that are set up under the Act.
So the insurance exchanges are set up to be an online marketplace for health insurance. So people compare them to Expedia or Travelocity for airplanes, for flights. So you would be able to go online, search for insurance plans and purchase and make sure that all the plans you look at are easy to compare. So the law makes insurance plans to be compared apples to apples instead of making it really confusing about what you're purchasing. So an exchange will be available to all individuals or small businesses who would like to purchase insurance. Their intention is to, of course, make insurance transparent and to help control the cost of premiums.
States are also setting up these exchanges, but for example, in Ohio, we don't have one. How will that all pan out if Ohio chooses not to participate in the exchange program?
So every state has an option. They can have their own. They can actually set up several within their state if that's how their marketplace works. But they can have their own and operate their own insurance exchange, or they can have the federal government run the state exchange for Ohio. Or a third option is actually a partnership where they have an arrangement with the federal government and with the state of Ohio on how to manage and run the exchange. The states all have to make these decisions by November 16th of this year. They have to declare what their intent is, and so that they can begin to be ready, because they have to be up and functioning by October of 2013.
Theoretically, then, these exchanges are sort of like a brokerage database. Ideally, I guess you'll have multiple options to choose from.
You would have multiple options. So the private insurance companies will be on the exchange. States also have an option of putting a public option if they so choose to put on the exchange. They will have all the basic services and coverage that you're going to be required to have. And there will be four basic plans, ones that has a 60% value, 70, 80, 90. And there'll be catastrophic plans for individuals under 30. And in the small business exchange, a state can allow businesses with up to 50 employees or up to 100, they have a choice, where small businesses can shop for their insurance online. And then in 2017, any business will be able to shop on the exchange for insurance.
And the theory behind these exchanges is that it's supposed to help drive down, or at least keep from rising.
Absolutely. So it's open competitiveness. It's transparency in being able to see your competitors' prices and having those things help keep costs in control.
Will the state and the federal government potentially be able to be in the business then of selling health insurance? I suppose that they could choose to. I have not heard any decisions in our local states that they're going to be a public option, but other states may choose to do that.
So what else should people know, Katie, about the Affordable Care Act that maybe they've just not thought about yet, but will be surprised to learn?
Well, I think, you know, for businesses, when they think about what's happening in 2013, there's a couple things that are changing immediately, and that would be around the W-2s. So if you have more than 250 employees, you need to start reporting on their W-2s how much you put in for their insurance every year. It's not a tax implication, but it's something employers need to know. The other thing people need to know in 2013 is if you're a high-income earner, if you earn more than $200,000 a year as an individual or $250,000 as a couple, Medicare taxes are going up in 2013 above those thresholds. So your first $200,000 is taxed at the current rate. Above $200,000 is taxed at the higher rate.
Katie, thanks so much for being our guest. And if folks would like to contact you,
You can go through our website at reform.healthfoundation.org.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is BusinessWise. My guest today is Dan Bizik. Dan is the president and founder of College & Beyond. And Dan, you help families and students figure out college process, make decisions about how to finance the cost of college, what's the best college options for them. But one thing that I hear a lot about, and I'm pretty passionate about right now myself, is this whole concept of student loan debt. I think as a society and as a country, we've done a very poor job of educating our students and their parents of the magnitude and the what I call the shackles that student loan debt can have around students, and they have to drag it around with them forever.
How scary is it that we crossed the $1 trillion mark when it comes to student loans this year, which is more than credit card debt or, you know, or consumer debt out there?
It's unbelievable. You can get a student loan so much easier than you can get a credit card.
When you think about it, a freshman can actually get a $5,500 student loan without a job, without a co-signature, and without a good credit score. And so that money's handed to them. The problem truly comes down to, though, that parents often think that the student can take out loans for every bit of the college cost. And yet the reality is when that happens, now mom and dad are participating in that loan as a co-signer.
And sometimes it's not even mom and dad. Sometimes it's grandma and grandpa. And if the student doesn't pay that loan back, then the co-signers are responsible. And I can guarantee you, they will have to pay.
You get the whammy of it affecting the parents, grandparents, aunts or uncles' credit score. It's going to haunt them for years, because anytime a default takes place on that loan that they signed on, it then becomes their responsibility. And as we know, parents, as they age, are at a different phase of life. They're dealing with a fixed income. You know, they're trying to survive through retirement, and suddenly they have this additional payment that comes in, because most of these student loans have a minimum of 10 years worth of payback. Yeah, you know, the good news is there have been some modifications that have been made for some income-based repayment plans and things in the industry, but we're still dealing with an incredible amount of not knowing the details by a lot of families when it really comes to the bad side of it.
Student loan debt is not dischargeable in bankruptcy?
It isn't. Yeah, can you imagine that? I mean, whether it's these federal loans or the private student loans that are out there, every bit of it is protected. And so these lenders have a big deal.
It's the American dream to go to college.
But it's
so expensive. Maybe the parents just don't have the money. They've not planned properly. What do you say to a family?
Families have to be smart. They've got to have conversations ahead of time so that they're working through the details. And so it's truly the fact that they've got to be engaged, and also they have to make smart choices. It's all about choices. Where is the student going to go to school? What types of things are they going to do? And making sure that, again, they talk about the difficulties for the family as far as paying for it up front.
So when should these conversations occur?
Absolutely. Earlier in the process, the better. So whether you're dealing with your kids and talking to them when they're in middle school, whether it's early in high school, you've got to give them those reality checks, because if you look at loans as the perfect alternative and the best way to pay for colleges, it's going to come with a black cloud that follows you and a lot of bondage along the way.
So Dan, if folks would like to learn more about you and College and Beyond, what's your contact information?
They can reach me at 859-283-2655.
I'm Crystal Faulkner with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is BusinessWise. Crystal, the topic I want to talk about today is business valuations. You know, a lot of businesses have a need for evaluation, and many times that need occurs before they realize it. You may want to value your business if you're positioning it for sale in several years and want to see what the target is. You may want to value your business if you're looking at some type of an agreement with key employees to give them options to buy in the business. There's many reasons why you may want to value your business.
And Tom, certainly one big reason is if you want to make a gift of your business before the end of 2012 to take advantage of what I perceive, and many do, generous tax laws related to the gift and estate tax rules that are available today.
Well, many people are doing that, and in fact, so many are doing that, that if you want to do that, you better line up a valuation expert soon, because they're very busy right now trying to get all these done prior to the end of 2012. But, you know, Crystal, one reason to do a business valuation is to see why your business isn't worth as much as you thought it was. Oftentimes, business owners think their business is worth 3x, and really it's only worth 1x, and maybe it's just not as profitable as it should be.
You know, it's that emotional thing that gets in the way, again, of good, solid thinking, and you're absolutely right. You know, a business owner has poured their entire life, in many cases, their heart, their soul, their passion, their energy into a business, but it may not be worth as much as you think it is to an outside third party. So the key is an objective valuation as to what that business is worth today, and then figure out what you need to do to drive value in your business based on where you stand currently.
Once you understand the value drivers, you can position your business oftentimes to have more value. And I know we've both experienced it where people thought they were going to sell their businesses, and they positioned it so well that it became a lot easier to run the business, and they kept them.
You know, one thing I always mention to people who are considering selling somewhere down the road is that you have to be sure that you sell your business enough to get enough cash after tax to be able to support the kind of lifestyle that you want to have as you go into retirement. So again, it's just not going to happen because you're hoping and praying it does. You really need to take action and a very specific plan on how you're going to achieve the result that you need so you can have an enjoyable life.
Well, and it's very challenging to sell your business and receive as much proceeds after tax that you can invest and get the flow of income that your business generates for you. You know, your business may be a risky asset in a sense because you've got a lot of your assets tied up in it. But generally, if it's doing well, it will provide a greater return than what the after-tax proceeds from that business will do.
The other point that I think needs to be mentioned here is certainly taxes and how you position and structure your business for sale will ultimately play a big role. So again, the whole concept is that you just can't wait until a year or two before you want to exit your business. You really need to start planning for that exit sooner rather than later. And the first step is understanding what the value is today so you can actually adjust your goals, if you need to more realistic ones.
And it's a great way to benchmark your success as a business owner.
We always say if you don't have something that you can measure, then it's not going to be achieved. What gets measured gets done. So by putting specific action plan in place to drive increased value in your business and then attaching to that measurable actions so that you can achieve those goals is really critical. For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.